So this is our fourth day. Yes, of course, it's our fourth day, and that leads us to point four of the lower jhana practice, the 7-point mind training. And so I'll just dive in again, and I've got quite a lot to say, I'm afraid. It just seems like to grow and grow these pages I've got in front of me. If you look at the amount of slogans we need to tackle today, it looks quite inconspicuous. We just got the two, yes. But then the two have five forces on each of them, so that makes 10, but never mind. So what we've been doing on this retreat so far, we've been putting these slogans, when we're done with them, into the big magical bowl, and then this cauldron goes to Amala, and then we're offering it in the evening, we're offering it to the shrine. So you see all these slogans on the shrine here. So today our topic, these two slogans both fall in the category of using the practice in your whole life. And it's about the energy and the forces that go into the practice. It's a kind of differentiation of the type of forces that you're using for your Dharma practice. So there's we've got two slogans here. And the first one reads, a summary of the essential instructions, train in the five forces. So it's train in the five forces. And then obviously we need to go into what are those five forces. But first, I'll say a bit more about what this point is about. So basically, this is the forces that we're using to make our lives a life of Dharma practice. And it's forces that we're using to train ourselves to move towards awakening in our lives. And so it's the exertion that goes into living and dying as well, because that's the second slogan of today. Like how to do that from the point of view of the Dharma practice, according to this Lojong system at least. So that is the rough sort of idea of this point. And we talked earlier on this retreat about how all of this practice is like a skill. And it's a skill that you can hone, that you need to practice in order to develop the skill. And it's like practicing the scales of the piano. And once you've practiced really well, you can perform this beautiful concert. So it's about practicing these forces in order for them to get stronger. And then we also need to understand that when we're beginning to practice, that those forces are much weaker and they're growing stronger as we practice. So I've been thinking about it in terms of, how you're doing, you're walking up this big hill somewhere. My hill at the moment is probably in the UK, in England. And you're looking at this top because you want to look at the view. And you're thinking that is quite a long way away. So you're starting to walk. And then you're looking again and think, oh, that's quite a long way away. But then you look back and you see how far you've already come. And then you feel like, okay, yeah, let's just keep walking. We'll get there. We'll get there at some point. We'll just keep walking. We'll just keep practicing. We'll get there at some point. And I thought it was quite interesting today. I came across, it was not today actually, it was yesterday. I came across this in one of the commentaries. I came across this idea that training to become an Olympic champion is probably easier, more difficult. It's more difficult than gaining enlightenment. I just thought that is quite encouraging, isn't it? Just all this energy that goes into, becoming Olympic champion. Well, you need your body and you need your mind, you need your determination. And in the practice that we're doing, it could be relatively simple because the only thing we need is our mind and the determination, and we just need to put the energy in. And then we can get there, and we can get there. Why not? If we keep practicing, there's no reason at all why we shouldn't get there. So that's quite encouraging, I thought. And I've also been thinking about like using these forces, using any kind of energy that you're putting into the Dharma practice. It's mainly about overturning these old unhelpful habits. It's that unhelpful conditioning that you're trying to move away from. And it just takes a lot of energy and effort to do that, because those habitual pathways in the brain, it is literal that, isn't it? It's these neural pathways in the brain that have been walked upon, as it were, like for millions of times sometimes. So it's difficult to bend the energy into a different direction. So that's what our life of practice are the forces and the energy we're putting into the practice. That's what it's sort of got to contend with. That's what we're doing. So no, it isn't easy, but it's doable. Yeah. We've got the evidence that it is doable. And I was also thinking about these forces that we're using for our practice life, as in our tradition we've got this concept of going for refuge. And somehow all these forces together, you could say, moving into a more and more skillful life, dharma practice, you could say, is some sort of going for refuge, all these forces together. Mm-hmm. And I've used this quote before, I'll use it again. Used well, this body is a ship to liberation, but it could also be an anchor into samsara. So yes, I find it quite interesting how much energy goes into the practice, and how much do I rest, and how much effort do I put in. Mm. I often struggle with that myself, like finding some sort of balance between resting and exertion. And I can't say I found it, not at all. But then a few months ago, I came across this, there was this thing on Facebook, and there was this doctor, a Japanese doctor who was like 120 years old, and he kind of gave his rules on how to live your life. And one of the rules was, if you're happy, you've got energy, which I thought is quite interesting, isn't it? So somehow that kind of energy comes from joy and from happiness. I just say that, I just dropped this in as a thought. And also, in terms of energy and the forces that we put into practice, I think it is a bit like, you know, how a flower opens when the sun comes out and then closes mm-hmm. again when the sun's away. I feel it's a bit like that. And maybe you would even say that mm-hmm. flower in our system is like the bodhicitta. It's that kind of wanting to open up, wanting to open up for the benefit of all beings, including yourself, do the practice for the sake of all of that. And that's like a kind of reaching out and a kind of opening, and sometimes it's also closing up. So there's a particular rhythm in that, I find, that I think are probably different for each of us, but you need to practice that opening, because it's not going to open. Sometimes it opens spontaneously, but you can practice the opening. So that's also what we're trying to do. So, that's my preliminary comments about this point. So we can go into the different forces. So there's five, training the five forces. So we'll go through them now. And the first one is the force of impetus or determination. And this is about setting a particular direction. And then in the practice, I think we've got, maybe we've got medium goals and we've got longer term goals. And so we could have this goal initially about becoming more patient or more relaxed, or that's the kind of goal that we often have. And then we do the meditation with that kind of goal in our mind somehow. But then often a bit later, it's that goal starts to shift, and it becomes a kind of longer term goal, as it were. And then it can become, it could also become more compassion and more wisdom, because there's no end to it. But you could also have that goal could be awakening, couldn't it? Like full awakening, for the sake of all beings. So bodhicitta would be that. So wanting to have that clarity of mind in order to be able to respond appropriately to the world around you and spontaneously, skillfully. So that's the kind of setting a direction. So that's what we've got. All of us have probably something in our minds like that, you know, the kind of direction that you're going into. And in the meditation, it's a bit more simple in terms of you're doing the meditation. So what you're doing is your determination is like going back to the breath, getting concentrated, being more present. So you've got those kind of goals around the meditation as well. So rather than just drifting through life, there is a particular direction that you're going into that might not be visible to others, but it is there in the mind somehow. Sampajnana, you could say. That is another way of approaching it. So you're from that determination comes a course of action. It translates in actions. So yes, and in order to set this direction in terms of the bodhicitta, wanting to reach enlightenment for the sake of all beings, there is a kind of mechanism in play which is about, well, you need to fall in love with the world and with people somehow. So that's then it all comes from that somehow, that determination. And you need to fall in love with the practice. If that makes sense at all, does it? A few nods are always good. So the practice could become a source of joy. I just got this memory of going into, I was doing this pilgrimage in 2000, it was with a friend, and we were in Bodh Gaya, and there was a Tibetan monk just sitting there near the gate of the Mahabodhi temple. He was just sitting there with a few other people, other monks, and this monk smiled at me, and he smiled. It was just like the smile was kind of like reaching out and arriving at me, and there was just so much joy in that smile. And so somehow that joy is probably part and parcel of living a Dharma life and having that kind of determination to practice for the benefit of all. So giving priority to these forces of wanting to have clarity and respond with love, that in any kind of way, small ways, it's going to challenge these strong, habitual, unhelpful habits. Mm. So that is a lot of work is done in that respect. So we got our moments in the day that we can choose to go with the old habit or to go with the newly formed habit, responding from love and compassion rather than habitually from clinging and contracting. So that's our first force. And I just thought we could just take a few minutes to reflect about our determination and our direction. Just a few minutes. Just connecting, if you can, at this moment, just connecting more deeply with what impetus, what is the motor of your practice, your Dharma practice. is the force of determination, and we could talk a bit about what came up for you this afternoon in the group, if you like. So we're moving to the next one. I shall make sure I speak loudly enough. So the next force in the Dharma practice is familiarization. Familiarization. That's the one. And this is mainly about going back again and again and again and again and again to the practice, and again and again. So in order in that the practicing of the scale, so getting it completely in your fingertips, getting the practice completely in your fingertips, persevering, so that the practice becomes part of you, that it becomes totally familiar. And so the practices that come to mind, we probably got quite a bit of experience with here, is like mindfulness, for instance. That is one of those practices that you come back to again and again, and you can also easily start seeing the results of it in your life. And practicing kindness, being mindful of body, the Satipatthana Sutta. So whatever you're doing, familiarize yourself, get used to being aware of how you feel, what you're feeling in the body, what's happening around you. So bring the mind back again and again to the practice. And in our particular practice system this week is coming back again and again to the practicing of bodhicitta. So not an easy one, but we can do it. We just got to do it. So coming back to the two kinds of bodhicitta, the acting out of compassion and the wisdom, so understanding more deeply what is happening in your experience, and understanding that, like we were talking about yesterday, that there is actually nobody to blame. The blame is all about the ego clinging, is the blame really, if there's any blame. So coming back to that again and again and getting really, really familiar with that. So it becomes second nature. So that is the force of familiarization. And we can move on to the next one. So the next force that we're using in our trying to bend that habitual mindset in another direction is virtuous seeds. It's called virtuous seeds, actually.
Seeds or deeds?
Seeds, but could also be deeds. It's both. But in the text is the sowing of the virtuous seeds. That's the term here, or positive seeds. So in the practice, so the virtuous seeds is about not taking a break from the practice at all, and it's about that you can actually dedicate your practice to bodhicitta at all times and any kind of time. And the Tonglen is an example of that, that you can practice the Tonglen in the moment. But I must say, I haven't done much of it, but I'm quite inspired by this, is that you can dedicate any activity to bodhicitta. You can dedicate your watching the television to bodhicitta. You can working in the garden to bodhicitta, and you can dedicate any activity to bodhicitta. It's just if you have that kind of mindset, it turns it into a virtuous activity. And I'm hopeful that we're going to hear Dardo Rinpoche, the day in the life of Dardo Rinpoche tonight. We're going to do hopefully hear that. And I'll just read you out a short passage. This is how the text started. Suvajra is recorded as day in the life of Dardo Rinpoche. Mm-hmm. So he writes, Dardo Rinpoche's daily program ran as follows. He regularly rose between 4 and 4:30. He washed and dressed while visualizing himself in the form of a deep blue bull-headed figure called Vajrabhairava, or Diamond Terror, the wrathful form of Manjushri, the embodiment of wisdom. At the same time, he recited prayers of purification and repeated mantras. He continued to do this while he was cleaning his teeth, which consequently took between 40 and 50 minutes. He then ate a light breakfast and sat for a period of formal meditation. So it's just incredible, isn't it? It just sounds quite over the top. But if you could do that, it really literally means that all of the activity is dedicated to the benefit of all beings. It's just the brushing the teeth and the watching the telly. You could do that with that kind of idea in mind. So basically, that is the what the virtuous seeds are about. So we're moving on to our number four, the fourth force that we're using, which is the force of repudiation.
Would you say that again, please?
Repudiation, it's like saying no, basically. I think in our tradition of meditation instruction, sometimes this is recommended in a meditation that as a tool, and not to repress anything, but sometimes just say no, 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 not now. This is not something I would like to continue. Because it's not something that's making me happy. It's not something that makes other people happy. No. So you're noticing yourself going into particular thoughts. It could be kind of thoughts of needing to protect yourself in a kind of unhelpful kind of way, or you can notice yourself in a getting into jealous thoughts or thoughts of envy. So again, not with an attitude of like this is not allowed or judgmental, but just saying no, this is not where I want to go with this. And I can also see that if I continue with this, this is not going to lead to my own happiness and the happiness of others. And it is quite interesting, I find, that the small ways in which we cling. I can notice it myself sometimes, like when I'm eating or I see something, like maybe it's on a retreat and I've got, I see the strawberries and I'm thinking, I really want to have those strawberries. And I don't want to share them with anybody else. So there is that kind of, it's a small kind of thing, but it's good to recognize it and to recognize it for what it is. And you can practice with just letting that go. Yeah. So basically, this repudiation, this fourth force, is about abandoning ego clinging thoughts. So you're deeply, deeply knowing that particular mental states are not leading to any happiness. And you say no to them. No, we said no quite a lot now. Time to move on, maybe. So the fifth force that's used in the practice is the force of aspiration. And this is the wish to benefit all beings, is an aspiration. And it's really important to not see that as I am going to save all beings or I am going to benefit all beings. It's more like it's kind of being part of a force, or a larger force, or all kinds of united forces that work for the benefit of all beings. So it's not me that needs to do that. And you're just part of all of that, and just being in this movement of order although obviously it has its problems, but mostly it's a force for the good, and just being part of that, you're not sort of in it alone, and that's part of other forces, other movements, other people out there who are trying to work towards benefiting other people. So the aspiration is just to not to forget to moving towards wisdom and compassion. That's the bodhicitta again. And I don't know how, but I do think this works, this aspiration thing, doesn't it? It really works.
Mm-hmm.
We've probably all tried it in one way or another. I was thinking about it as it's a bit like an object that's been launched into space, and it's just moving and it's just going somewhere. That's how I see it, at least, these wishes of aspiration. They're kind of putting the vehicle in a particular direction. So it seems like another image I had this morning is about, I think I hear an airplane in the sky right now, but sometimes you see these, is it contrails? Are they called contrails? Mm-hmm. So maybe the aspiration is like the plane, and then there is still that kind of perfume. It's not exactly perfume, it's quite horrible, isn't it? But maybe in our imagination. It's like it's still influencing the mind stream after the aspiration has been done, as it were. So I know we no way got to the bottom of all of this, but I'm just laying it out. Those are the five forces, and I'm finding them really encouraging, and I'm finding them really encouraging, particularly if you start to pay attention to them. Especially the one about the repudiation, I just noticed that when you're doing that, it comes up in the mind, no, we don't want to go here, that is actually part of the practice, it's mm-hmm. the force that you're putting into the practice. So if you start to maybe try it out a bit today, like trying to be mindful of those five forces and noticing how much energy is going into the practice, and then I find that really inspiring to think about it in that way, and just notice that there is much more energy going into the practice than I thought, and some of that energy is actually the energy of that familiarization that you set it in motion in the past, and it's kind of paying dividend, it's paying off in the present, and that is such a relief, I find, to notice that. You actually have become skilled in particular things. You're noticing, okay, I'm not doing such and such anymore. I've left that behind. And I hope that you'll find it useful to think about it in those terms. So basically, that is the what I had to say about those. The first slogan. So just before I get into the next topic, maybe we could just have a few minutes again, and then I'll put this in the big pot. So our first slogan of this point was about how to live a life of Dharma practice. And then the next slogan in this point four, it's actually slogan number 18 we're at. The Mahayana instructions on how to die are the five forces. And it also says, as a special instruction, posture is important. Which I'll go into at the very end. But yeah, so the Mahayana instructions on how to die are the five forces. Oh no, I shouldn't go into the pot yet. I'm premature.
Come back here.
Yeah. Okay. So we're having, in the Lojong tradition, we've got this whole set of instructions on how to apply those forces in the dying process, which is quite interesting. And also, so it's basically how to practice at death. And but this is, of course, only when you're actually able to prepare for death, because obviously, often you don't. It's been a bit morbid, but some time ago I was just reflecting on how many ways there are to die. It's just endless, isn't it? There's endless ways. And you know, some can be quite sudden and some can be more gradual. So will we have time to apply these practices at when the time of death is coming? I don't know. Some of them, as we'll go into later, I'll go into that later, I won't go into that right now. But well, you could make a case for following these instructions at any time. And the following instructions, because you don't know when you're going to die. And we had the four reminders in our PowerPoint 1, preliminaries. And one of the reminders is the reminder of impermanence and death. So, but many of us probably will be in a position that at some point we'll be diagnosed with some sort of illness, and then we may have some time to prepare. So most of this applies to that. Or we're diagnosed with something. And then it also depends on how much clarity of mind will you have, how much strength will you have to do any kind of practice. I used to think about when I was a bit younger, I was thinking, oh yeah, when I get older, I'll practice like every day. I'll spend the whole day in meditation. I'm not that old yet, but I also know since that I heard about an older order member who's now in her late 80s or 90s, I think she may be, and at some point she just didn't have the mental energy to meditate, because you know, your body gets old, your strength goes, so you might not have that time, that energy to meditate when you're older, or you might not have that clarity of mind. So it's another reminder, isn't it, just let's practice while we can, which is right now. And an order member I know, I can actually just say his name, he's Jinananda, he's in West London, he's been diagnosed with terminal cancer quite recently. And when he was going through the first phases of his treatment, when he didn't know yet, you know, what the outcome is going to be, he found it really hard to meditate. It was nearly impossible to meditate because of the painkillers, and it just clouded his mind. But the thing that he could do is chanting, so he did that. He did that, and that really helped him. But he is, you know, he's a bit better in terms of in a better state to meditate right now. But he does know that he hasn't got long to live. It's gonna be maybe the end of the year. It could be. But I just thought that another thing that he has a blog, and he's just recently, a few days ago, written another update, and he writes about how his brother is dragged into a lawyer to get his affair sorted out, you know, to get a will. And He's also writing in his blog, and I just thought I'd read you a fragment because, I just thought I'd read you a fragment of his blog, which is available to all, so I hope he's not going to mind me reading it out to you. So he says, "At present I can meditate my way through this, but it's hard work getting quiet. I used to have a student with quite severe cerebral palsy who couldn't sit still. I get a slight sense of what he has to work through with meditation. The practice, though, is to sit with your experience, to keep meeting it as it is, to be soft and curious with an experience that you don't want to know about. So that is what I do. It is to be receptive, both to what is being communicated and to my own unwillingness to hear. I tend to sit there with that assumption we have that one is just dealing in meditation with some internal communication. But I think it's helpful not to see it that way, not to practice your meditation in a way that seems to isolate you. Anyway, what is being communicated comes with the experience of the breath. But in order to be able to listen, I have to calm that compulsive flinching away from what is unwanted, as if my experience could, by some miracle, be other than it is. Ducking around difficult stuff may have worked in the past, but not now. And there is one thing this experience of mine has going for it once it gets past our guard. This is that it is our secret and most intimate link with one another. One never wanted to get that close. This helpless, hopeless, brute reality has to force itself on you. But maybe at some point the breath carries some quality of belonging, of our belonging to one another, and of a sense of care, that it is maybe less self-protective, that can relax and break open to the world." That's Jananda.
Mm-hmm.
He's quite a good writer. So he's been editing the Wisdom Beyond Word book, and he's done Living with Awareness, etc. series, Know Your Mind. So he's done a lot of editing of those Samarakshita's books.
Yeah.
And he's written some books, his own books as well. So on that note, I just thought let's go into those five forces. So these forces that I sketched out earlier are now in a different order, because they are significant, the order is significant of them. So from this point of view, you would start with the virtuous seeds. So and I'm thinking about this Jananda finally doing his well. So it's important to give away possessions and to overcome attachment to belongings at that stage. So I do think that our belongings, they really bind us somehow. Just thinking about owning a car, and you always have to worry a bit about it, like, is it okay, is it going to start, is there enough fuel in it, is somebody going to scratch it or hurt it or steal it. And it's the same with a house. Yeah, you get that. There's so much, the responsibility and the worry and the care and everything that goes into that. So that kind of, we're encouraged to just let go of that. Because if you're giving it away, you don't have to worry about these things anymore. Yeah. So you kind of get a bit lighter. And months ago, well, it's longer than that, never mind, there was a documentary on the British television about, it's quite rare this, but there were five friars living together. I can't remember what their order was, Dominicans or something like that. So they made a documentary of how these people lived in a city kind of life, and every half year they do a poverty check. So they go through there, because their vows are about not owning anything. So literally, one of these guys, you could see he had three clothes peg at the back of his room, and it just had three garments on, like a hoodie and another robe. That was it. And so they're going through the house to see if they have the minimum, if they don't have too much. So you see them looking in the kitchen drawers. They're all together. They're looking in the kitchen drawers. They're seeing these two ice scoops. Okay, do we need two ice scoops? No, one can go. You know, do we need these two big pans? No, one can go. So they're going through the whole house and they're kind of eliminating everything that is that they don't actually need. And then they're giving that, they're putting it on the table, and that's where, you know, people come to, they make food for the homeless. And that's, and people can take stuff away, or it's not only homeless, it's just, you know, poor, for the poor. So I just thought that is quite inspiring, isn't it? But it is that freedom that comes from not having any possessions. So at the time that death approaches, giving away one's possessions, overcoming attachment to them is a thing that lightens everything up. So that's the virtue seed. And then we have the force of aspiration. There we have it again, the force of aspiration. And shall we do this? Maybe this makes things a bit clearer as well. This we do that transference of merit at the end of the puja, and we often do it at the end of a retreat, or some people do it privately at the end of the meditation or the chapter or whatever. So you transfer these merits. So that's also a force of aspiration. So you're dedicating everything that has that your life has contributed to, you dedicate that to the benefit of all beings. So that is also aspiration. It's a wish. So, and you dedicate it to you just dedicate your whole life's project to the benefit of beings. I find that quite a powerful idea, actually, just that, because, you know, just dedicating the merits of a meditation compared to dedicating your whole life to the benefit of others is quite a strong practice. And in the traditional text, this is also about wishing that any future lives, that you'd go beyond ego clinging, at least in the future life. So you're wishing that as well. You're wishing that for future lives, for yourself, however and whether you are reborn. So that's the second force here. And then we have the force of repudiation at that time of in the dying process, clearly saying no to negative influences and saying no to negative habits. I just also read in Jinan's blog that a friend of his talks about his mother dying and how in the dying process she just let go of some lifelong habits just like that. And it was watching Coronation Street, you know, which is one of those English soaps that have been running for decades. So she just let go of that, just like that, knowing that death was approaching. That was, and then she stopped reading novels, which is just really interesting, isn't it? Just you're letting go of these habits that you think this is not contributing anything, it's actually not very helpful maybe, so let's not do those. And you're also letting go of, if you can, of this idea that there is a truly existing self. And interestingly enough, this whole ego clinging thing and this thought that a self exists is probably at its high point when death nears, because it becomes so highlighted, the clinging to life. And I really like this quote by Rinzhen Shigpo, who is a British Tibetan teacher. And I'm just doing this from memory, so it might not be completely accurate, but he's saying death is like going to the dentist to have a tooth pulled, but then it's the entire body. I know, but that's it's kind of the I had a tooth pulled in June, and I experienced quite a bit of clinging and grief about the tooth going, etc. And but I did use it. I did use it to let go of ego clinging, recognizing it as such, and also thinking about death. That must be thinking about this quote. It was quite helpful at that point, and just you know, really experiencing that clinging to. To the body you have been identifying with most of your life. So that is that's that the third force here, and then we're coming back to the force of impetus and resolve. And here it's quite predictable what that might be. That force is that you are resolving to practice bodhicitta. Just determine that that's what you're going to do. That's what you're deciding to do. I'm going to practice bodhicitta. And we're not, you know, we're just still, so you're still practicing. You're still practicing in that stage, still determined.
Mm.
Yeah. It's quite a strong thought, isn't it? And then lastly, it's the force of familiarization. Familiarization. And which I think is really interesting, because it is at the time of death, the habits will just still be there. Our habits will still be there, well, most of them. And so any kind of practice that you've been doing quite a lot will be available. So if you've been doing a lot of mindfulness of breathing, might not be too hard to do a bit of mindfulness of breathing, because that's what you used to. But I think that at the time of death, I mean, I was present at a friend's death a few years ago, and you just look around that hospital room, and you know, there's bleep, 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 there's lights flickering, there's, you know, the oxygen machine. You hear that, and the pumping of the machines, and the heart rate monitor, and you know, there's beep, 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 beep. And then there's the lights, there's quite strong lights, and there's nurses shuffling around, and people making, you know, you might hear other people as well, depending on where you are. So it's not kind of, it's like quite a distracted environment. And then you might also be on morphine, and you might be in pain. And all of that is going to make practice much more difficult. So any kind of habit that you set up in the past is going to help you being less distracted in that state. So again, that's also quite a good reason to stick to the practice. It's going to be really helpful to you at that time. So, and they also got some instructions about the actual, so this is the last bit, the posture is important, there is even that, it's Tibetan system, so yes, they've got posture here as well, so they're recommending to lying on your side, like, you know, like the Parinirvana Buddha, and then to practice Tonglen, using the breath. And looking into the nature of reality at that point, looking at mind, looking at nature of mind, and seeing the insubstantial quality of that. So that is what's recommended in the tradition, in this particular tradition, how to approach death. And I'm sure that there's lots of helpful bits in there for us today. So. For now, that's what I've got to say about these slogans. It's quite strong, isn't it, all this stuff about death? So what I propose to do is we'll just have a break until 12 o'clock and come back to do some Tonglen practice. I suggest to do the break in silence, so I could just reflect on what this topic is brought up for us. Yeah? Okay.